Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. On May 10, 1993, Julie Papiavis' life was changed forever because a teenager ran a red light. She suffered a severe brainstem injury and medically died. She said she was immediately transported to heaven's doorstep, where her grandmothers told her that her body would heal and that she should go back and be happy. A month later, Julie awoke and found herself paralyzed and helpless in a rehabilitation hospital. Although medical experts said she would never walk again, she didn't listen. Today she's here to tell her story and talk about her book, Go Back and Be Happy. Julie, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you for having me.
Describe your life prior to your accident in May 1993.
Very busy. I was working all the time. I was a working professional person. I was traveling with friends. I was visiting with family. I was just busy all the time, but I was really working quite a lot and really wanted to continually build my career. That was really pretty important to me, and so that's what I spent a lot of time doing, and also exercising. I've always been a runner, and I was training for a biathlon. I was always trying to train for some race or something. I've always been pretty goal-oriented.
And how old were you, Julie?
I was 29.
Okay, and then the accident occurs in May of 1993. Then what happens?
Well, I was leaving. I had just gotten back from a trip to Cancun, just a last-minute quick trip. My girlfriend said, you work too much, one of my girlfriends, and she's like, let's just go away. So we went to Cancun for a quick trip, and it was fun, and I just came home that Sunday for Mother's Day, and so spent Mother's Day with, actually I don't remember this, but I don't have a good memory of it, with my family, and the next day I went to work, and after work I went to the shopping mall to get some moisturizer for my sunburn, and when I was leaving the shopping mall, I was making a left-hand turn out of the mall, and there is two lanes going each way, straight, and it's 35 miles an hour. But a young gentleman was speeding at, they thought, about 50 miles an hour, and he ran the red light, and he T-boned me right in the ledge of my driver's door. And, you know, when you're in a little sports car like I was, your head's, like, right above the window line, and him traveling so fast, the force of the crash twisted my head around and severed most of my brain stem. And I didn't even know your brain really, I didn't even know it had a stem, but I have since, of course, learned that you, as my neurosurgeon said, you live in your brain stem and controls all your involuntary functions. And so since most of mine was severed, my body instantly began dying. And there, thankfully, was an off-duty paramedic at the scene who saw and heard the crash and ran over and called 911 right away. As soon as he saw it, and he ran over and jumped in the back of the car, broke a window and jumped in the back, and started an airway. And he said when he was lifting my head, he saw that my pupils were blown already. And so, obviously, there was major brain damage, and there was an off-duty doctor at the scene also on his cell when the paramedic got to him, and he said, you know, don't go in there, don't move her, I think this woman is dead. And he said, we've got to try and do something. We have to do something. And then he said, I've been trained. I'm a paramedic. And the doc said, go ahead. And so he also was on the phone with 911. And so the paramedics came there 2 minutes later because they were right down, there was a fire station right down the street. And when they got to me those 2 minutes later, I already had no blood pressure. And my body had, like, furthered the dying process. And so Jaws of Life took my car door off and scoop me into an ambulance, and the University Hospital, Loyola University Hospital and Trauma Center, they got me there within 14 minutes, down the big expressway going, one of the major expressways going into the city of Chicago, and my body in the ambulance completed the dying process where you go into agonal breathing, it's called, and those, I guess, are called medically your last breath. And then I had released all of the water out of my body, and that is, you know, when somebody is dying. And so when I got to Loyola, you know, they called ahead like they always do to tell what's coming in, and my neurosurgeon, John Shea, was waiting, and he did an EEG on my brain, and there was no activity. So in most states, I could have been legally declared dead, but in the state of Illinois, we have a law where your next of kin, he has to be contacted before you can be legally declared, which is something that, another message I want to get out with this whole story, that Dr. Shea is like, you need to let people know with, there's different laws in different states. And, you know, like, for example, if I was in the state of Florida, it's one state that I know, because my parents go down there too for the winter, that they can just legally declare someone without the giving notice to the family. And so he said that this is really an important law that was in place for me, because they put me on life support and called my parents. And thankfully, we were getting along that day. No. I don't know how any parent would say, oh yeah, just take
pull
them
the
out.
Plug, yeah.
It's just so, you know, so quickly, and I just think anybody would, of course, need a moment for that. And the death rate from my injury is 96%. And with the 4% of people who live, most people die within 6 months due to infection. Like, I had double pneumonia, urinary tract, bladder, I had all kinds of infections, as you can imagine, with your body being, you know, so compromised. And so most people die of those injuries within 6 months after the initial injury. And the very few who remain living live like semi-vegetative in nursing homes, needing to be toileted and fed. So that was like the best case scenario that was given to my parents. And, you know, still, of course, they didn't want to pull the plug. And but he said, you know, her brainstem has been very compromised. Only 2 millimeters were left intact. The rest of it was lacerated. And so he said, we just do not expect her to live the night. And my dad's like, you know, what do we do? What do we do? He always very proactive. And Dr. Shea said, we pray. We pray. And so they did. And I obviously lived that night, and I stayed in a coma for about a little over a month, about 6 weeks. And they transferred me after a month from the trauma center to a rehab hospital, a Mary and Joy rehab hospital. And I woke up there just like you and I woke up this morning, like we all woke up this morning. And, you know, you're a little tired. It's okay, I got to get it together before you actually get moving and get going. And that's how I just woke up. And but I physically couldn't do anything. I was completely locked in my body. Laid there, I was paralyzed on my left side, and my eyes still don't work together. And but my left eye was shut because the muscles for my eyelid couldn't open it up.
So somewhere along the line in this story, you had this amazing experience of heaven. Was that instantaneous after the accident in the ambulance? I mean, do you have any idea when you actually went to heaven?
No, I have no idea when I went to heaven, but when I woke up, that was my first memory. You know, I looked and I knew I was in a hospital, and I thought, well, I know I wasn't sick. I don't know why I'm in a hospital. But the first memory I had was of seeing my deceased grandmothers in heaven and my experience with them and being in that perfect, beautiful place and them telling me that my body will heal and to go back and be happy. And so I thought, well, I'm so bad and I can't do anything. But at least I know, and I've always been a very faithful person. I was raised to be faithful. And I thought, well, at least God is paying attention. And obviously this is his will, that I'm awake and that I'm here. And he knows that I'm paralyzed and he knows that I'm so disabled. But at least he knows. So I will give it up to him. And I will work as hard as I can to live this life that he has left me with, that I've been given.
So you had a sense of this bright light. I mean, what was it like? A lot of people say bright light, peace.
Well, you know, it was just like a lit room, like a normally lit room, just just, it was all light. I was in this area, and it was all light, but the brightest light was coming from this long alleyway to the left. And I remember thinking, man, this is a narrow alleyway. You know, like when a lot of people die, like in the tsunami or something, you know, something like that. How do they all fit through that narrow alleyway? I remember thinking that. Mm. And that is where I was drawn to go, and that's where the brightest light. It was like coming, it was on the floor, and it was coming up the sides of the aisleway was the brightest light. And where I was, it was all open, and there were like no floor ceilings, and everything was round. There were no corners. And I just remember feeling, I knew that I was there because I was dead. I knew that, and I was okay with that. And I knew that I was dead, and I was, it was so, it was perfect peace. A stillness, not like, you know, when everything is still, like right before a storm. It's not that kind of stillness. It was just perfect peace.
And then your grandmothers just were there. It was just your grandmothers, no one else.
Yes, I just, you know, when you feel like there's somebody in the room, like I was trying to go down the aisleway, but when you know there's somebody there, all of a sudden I was in front of my two grandmothers. And I looked at them and I said, okay, girls, come on, let's go. And I waved with my right hand and like just thought, oh, well, how wonderful that they're going to go with me down this aisle. And that's when my grandmother, my mom's mom, did all the talking. And she had just passed away in March before my injury in May. And she said, no, you can't go with us. You have to go back. And that's when I was like, that's when I first felt tense and I was very nervous. And I pointed to my left side that was paralyzed. And I said, I can't go with you. I'm not physically, or I can't go back. I'm not physically okay. And that's when she looked at me and she said, your body will heal. And with these I mean, these long tunnels, her eyes are like these long tunnels of endless blue light. I could just feel, like it was like, when she said that, I was like wrapped in the Holy Spirit, like wrapped in this warm blanket. And I knew right then that everything was going to be okay. And then she said, go back and be happy. So I thought, okay, I can go back then.
Wow.
Because I knew it was the Lord speaking to me through her.
You said that part of you is thankful for what happened. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, look at the experience I have. I mean, so I can reflect on that whenever life gets hard, as it does for everyone. And, you know, I still have the disabilities that I have, even though I live a very functional life. I still have, you know, limited stamina, as you can imagine. I have definitely disabilities that I deal with, but everybody has something. And so many people are given so many curveballs in this life that this life is hard for a lot of people, and I feel like for everyone at one time or another. And I feel like I have this experience to be able to reflect on, and I can bring it to my mind at any time, and I think, well, I know that our Lord is paying attention, and that I feel like I'm really not alone. Mm. I may be by myself sometimes, but I don't ever feel like I'm completely alone, and that's so reassuring.
Did you ever get angry? I mean, angry that
When I first woke up, that was my memory, first memory of my grandmother's, but I was mad. I was like, how could this happen? How could this happen? I mean, I just thought, how could somebody, you know, I had lived a nice life in terms of, you know, being with friends and things, but I had never been, quote unquote, careless. I really had not ever done anything unlawful, certainly, or really randomly careless, and I thought, you know, when I heard what had happened, how I was injured, I thought, how could someone do that?
So where was your anger directed? At the person, the perpetrator, or was it anger at God?
No.
So nothing like, God, why did you allow this to happen? Just because of maybe your experience was so powerful that there was never any anger at God?
No, I was like, how could this happen to me, meaning the young boy who hit me? And, at one point I was like, you know, you saw this obviously happen. And you know what the way that I excused God was, because I remember telling the chaplain this when my parents had communion given to me, brought in every day. And so he's like, how do you think that God could allow something like this to happen? I said, well, he must have just turned his eye for just a minute. That was like my way of rationalizing.
Yeah. Let you off the hook, God.
Exactly. And the chaplain's like, no, he never turned away from you. And I thought, I know, but that was, you know, my way of rationalizing it.
Well, you struggled with depression after the accident, you've said. How did you make it through that?
Paxil.
Love it. Great.
I mean, that is the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is, and it's funny because my primary nurse at Marion J. Rehab Hospital was at my last speech that I gave, and the whole audience laughs when I say that, but she knows it's the truth, and I brought her up, and we were talking a bit about that, and I have, you know, I would have never been a good drug addict or anything. I just am not a big medication person. I just don't believe in anything like that. And so when they told me that I was going to have to go on antidepressant, I just said, well, I don't take drugs. And they were like, well, and she came to me. Her name was Zoe, and she's lovely. We're very good friends now. And she said to me, it's either that or we put you in a nursing home because you cannot participate in rehab when you are crying so badly. And she said, but you have to be able to participate in therapy. And so I said, okay, give it to me.
How long was your recovery in the rehab place? I mean, that had to be long.
I'm going to be 19 years in May, and they still pick at least two body parts every year.
Really?
And my vision is really bad because my eyes will never work together. And all they try and do is keep my left eye from floating out and bringing my left eye in to work more closely with my right, because I don't have any sense of balance because the nerves in my inner ear were severed, and because my one pupil, my left pupil, is blown all the time. It's permanently blown.
Hmm.
And so there's nothing that can constrict it. So I have vertigo all the time, and I have no sense of balance. And you really learn how to manage that, but the prism lens has helped me dramatically. And I have a separate pair for reading, a separate pair for work on the computer, but that has made it possible. And he said, you know, you could be in rehab for the rest of your life every day to do something with that eye, but we also want you to be able to live. And so we give you these lenses so that you're, and it looks like I just have, you know, thick, regular lenses.
So you had to do a physical rebuilding of your body as well as an emotional.
Yes, my left side was paralyzed, and I actually ran a triathlon about 5 years ago, but I've always been an athlete, and it is so true what they say about the spinal cord having a great memory, because I actually feel more stable when I'm running than when I'm walking. And I can only run so far because of my limited lung capacity, because of having pneumonia in both lungs all the time. But I do the best that I can. And I've been really able to build my left side strength as much as I can. I have a lot of atrophy in the muscles still, so my left side still feels very, very different than my right. And, you know, just the no sense of balance, that's why I look wobbly sometimes, or I bump into things literally sometimes. But I have built up the strength on my left side to be where I can functionally move around and walk places. And so I feel very lucky with as much function as I have. And that's taken a lot of time. And, you know, last year they just worked on my hip so that I could not have so much pain in my hip. And that's why they didn't want me, Dr. Shea doesn't want me running anymore, because of all the atrophy and just because of the pain. He's like, Julie, you just at some point need to stop doing it and do something else. So I swim, and I can only do the breaststroke because of my balance. And so I do what I can.
Yeah. Well, some point along the line, Julie, you had to decide that you were going to accept some of this. I mean, here you are, you know, physically limited, but you seem to have an incredible tenacity, but you had to come to a point of acceptance. I think that would be a big key, because you can either fight against it and, oh God, why did this happen to me? And I'm just, you know, feeling bad about it and about you and about myself and about all my circumstances now, or I can move into a phase of acceptance and really begin to even cultivate an attitude of gratitude for what did happen. Like you said, there's a piece of you, a big piece of you, that was thankful for this.
Right. And you know, it's so great that you said, use the word acceptance, because I think that is so key. And I work with so many survivors and families, so many people. And I tell them, too, that acceptance is key.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, we all have something
right. That
comes into our lives that, you know, we need to accept, and we need to say, well, okay, obviously it's not something that we wanted, but it's something that we've been given for whatever reason. And
those are the things that keep us dependent on God, aren't they?
Totally, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's when, I mean, he wants us to reach out to him to have a closer relationship with him. That's what he wants. And so when people don't go to prayer and they don't go to their faith, they think, he's calling you. He wants you to reach out to him and to have a relationship with you. And you will see the wonderful benefits that they can bring you. I mean, he's your father. He loves you, and he wants just the best for you, and so he will help you.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful, coming from someone like you who's gone through what you've gone through. So describe the spiritual changes that happened as a result of this for you.
Well, you know, I mean, honestly, I didn't have so many changes, only because, my family, I was raised Catholic, and my godmother was a nun. A couple of my aunts were nuns, so I'm like, and a couple of my uncles went to the seminary, and it's like, so it was always, faith was always in my family. And I remember my aunt was a nun who is in her 90s now, lovely, and it's so funny because I remember always her at like a family function, talk to Jesus, just talk to Jesus. Jesus is your brother. Talk to Jesus. And it was like he was at our dinner table. He was just a part of our lives.
Yeah.
And it's okay. And you know, and she really was saying, just, I mean, it was always about having God present in our lives, just having God present. And so I always felt like he was present in my life. And I had just gotten divorced before my injury. And I remember distinctly laying in bed as I had just moved into my new apartment saying, okay, God, I've been a nice girl. I've always tried to do the right thing, and here I am, and where are you? Where are you? Where are you in my life? And
well, I think what happened, yeah, through what occurred with this heaven experience is that you experienced God.
Yes.
I mean, you had an encounter.
Yes.
You know, when we have an encounter with him, it changes us profoundly, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It absolutely does. And I don't know, I can say yes, that it strengthened my faith for sure. And I feel like, you know, that I have a very personal relationship with God because I was with him. I was before him. I felt his presence. I knew he was there.
What was it like for you to finally participate in a triathlon and finish it? I mean, that's astounding.
Oh, and you know, and that was the first one that I had done. I was just doing biathlons when I got into my injury, and like I said, I've always been a runner. And I had a wonderful team who worked with me, who stayed with me, who really, you know, were completely with me during the whole time, so I was never alone. And I had a great coach, and she knew Milton Elms, who was a U.S. Olympic swimming coach, and so he worked with me on the breaststroke, and I mean, I just had fabulous people around me during the whole thing. And you know what? I knew I was going to be so far behind in the swim because I couldn't do freestyle. But I had been a runner, and then the other part is doing a bike. And Dr. Shea would only let me do an indoor one because I don't have enough balance to ride a bike outside. So this is an indoor try. And that's the only way he would let me do it, because he said, because Julie, if you're out in that open water, somebody will kick you in the head. I'm not bringing you back from this twice.
I'm not bringing you back from this twice.
Like, sorry, no. And trust me, he takes no credit. He calls this a miracle. He absolutely calls it a miracle.
Oh my gosh, he calls me
his dead patient.
Oh, my gosh, his dead patient.
I'm like, okay, that's your sense of humor. All right.
Well, the cool thing about this is that you have taken this tragedy and you have used it to reinvest in life. And I think that's the redemptive piece, that you have, you know, your own outreach ministry now, that you're, you know, trying to raise awareness about brain injury and driving habits and all that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I speak to the Think First program, which is an international program that's actually run by the College of Neurosurgeons, was started by them. And the Department of Highway Transportation Safety is very involved in that. And I speak to many, many schools, to middle schools, to high schools, I speak to colleges, and I speak about injury prevention and that, you know, we have one brain, one spinal cord, and we need to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
We do, especially this one big thing about texting and driving, do this one exercise with the kids, especially in high school. And we're like, you cannot spell and drive.
Mm-hmm.
There is just no way. And they're now are as many texting accidents, crashes, as there are drunk driving.
Really?
It has gotten that bad. And it's ridiculous. And so we do this texting exercise. And the kids really, you know, they respond to my talks more, no, I shouldn't say more, but they respond greatly, especially like through Facebook and things, because, you know, the kids are all about the social media. And they respond greatly to my talks that I give. And actually, I just had a family from Canada that I spoke to yesterday who found my website, and their daughter, who's in her 40s, and she's now back living with her family because she was a pedestrian and she was hit by a car. And she's also a marathon runner, so that's another reason she reached out to me and really would like to do that again. But her parents were so thankful to me for getting my story out there, because they feel like it's, the mom said that, I just was led to get your book in the hospital library, and I just went and I got it at a hospital bookstore. And she said, and now my daughter's reading it. She goes, you don't understand how much hope you give to people. And I'm like, that was really my whole reason behind writing it, is because I just wanted people to know that this does not have to be
the end of the story. Absolutely. The story's not finished yet.
A detour.
Mm-hmm. So if there was one message you felt like you needed to convey from your story, what would it be?
That there is hope. Mm-hmm. That change is not always bad. That you can make great things happen out of change. That you can have a detour and just go a different way, but different does not have to mean bad or worse.
Julie, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. I hear they're looking to make a movie out of your story. Can you tell us a little bit about that and give us some contact information?
Yes. The producers of The Blind Side, Lani Netter Productions, is optioned the rights to my story, and we're going to do a movie based on the book, Go Back and Be Happy. And we're hoping to get it started, start filming later this year. And so we're hoping to get it done very quickly in about a year or so.
That's so exciting.
Please watch for that. Yes, and the Netters are lovely people, and they're really, they wanted to do the story, based on the book, and really a faith-based story. So they really, and they know how to tell stories well, as we find out from The Blind Side.
Absolutely.
They're lovely. So.
And how can folks get a hold of you if they would like to do that?
They can contact me through my website at www.gobackandbehappy.com.
That's awesome. Julie, God bless you, and thank you for the message of hope that you're offering to folks.
Oh, thank you, Rita, for giving me a chance to tell everybody about it. I really appreciate that.
Okay. God bless.
I had a big hole in my heart, and I was looking. I was looking everywhere.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.